welcome to Talking Beats with Daniel Lalchuk. That's me, and I'm so glad you're here. If you like what we do, I'd love it if you gave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you're so compelled, write a review. That really helps, and maybe tell a friend or family member. They might like the show as much as you do. If you want to get involved in the program, visit our website, talkingbeats.com, and click Support the Show, where you can make either a one-time or a recurring donation. As we look to continue having cliche-free conversations of real substance with a diverse range of the world's most compelling people, your support is so appreciated, especially as we look to expand and increase our offerings. If you have a question, comment, or thought, find us on social media, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, or if you wish to reach out directly, email me at daniel@talkingbeats.com. I'm so glad you're here. Let's get on with today's conversation. On today's program, music authority, Khalifa Sana. Since 2008, he's been a staff writer for The New Yorker, and prior to that, was popular music critic for The New York Times. He's out with a major new book called Major Labels, A History of Popular Music in 7 Genres, which David Letterman says, quote, unspools everything you need to know about 50 years of music, end quote. It's all in this book, as my guest lays out, the great place in the world for diversity in music and for the quality of performances, America. Where is American music going? What even is American music? And are the golden years of extraordinary creative talent behind us? Well, Khalifa Sana is here to talk this and much more. Welcome.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
I'd like to begin the conversation where you begin the book, right at the beginning. You're talking about an album that you played for your father while he was in the hospital. It's an album I was listening to this morning before we got on this call. It's the beginning of the book, the introduction, and it is an album, Klichau Dibon. Okay, not great pronunciation, but it's a collaboration between a Welsh harp player and a kora player from Senegal, near where your father had grown up. What is kora, and what is this album all about?
So the kora is a 21-stringed West African instrument. It's got a sort of a gourd for the body and then a post that has these strings attached, 10 on one side, 11 on the other. You play it sort of like a harp, and it's a foundational instrument for the traditional West African music, the tradition of what they call griots, right? So these are these singer-storytellers who sing the songs of a family. And, you know, my father grew up in Gambia, part of this tradition, part of the caste that was traditionally the patrons of the musicians. So members of his family traditionally would be the people who would pay the musicians to sing their praises. Musicians tend not to sing my praises because I became a music critic. But, you know, this tradition, you know, for him, this was kind of a, you know, this was what he grew up with. And so this record that was a collaboration between Sekou Keita and Catherine Finch, a harp player, was an example of these two traditions, this harp tradition and the kora tradition, kind of coming together. And so I kind of started the book with that because, you know, I think to my father, this was the music of his childhood, of his life. This was the music that felt like home. That said, he was a restless person. He left the Gambia. He became an academic, a historian of world religion, and spent most of his career teaching at Yale University. And so, you know, I relate to the idea that music can be a kind of a home, but also the restlessness, the idea that you might want to leave home, the idea that you might want to try and choose something different from what your life has chosen from you, for what your parents have chosen for you. And so I think, you know, when I was growing up, you know, living in Connecticut as a 14-year-old, falling in love with punk rock music, I think my dad was probably a little bit confused by that. But on some level, I like to think that he understood that impulse to find something totally different from what surrounds you and to embrace it. And I think I use that in the beginning of the book because I think there is this push and pull of music, right? Where we want something that is sort of, that is like us in some way, and we also want something totally different from us, right? The experience of looking at someone up on a stage, whether it's a rapper, whether it's David Bowie, whether it's a country star, it's typically those two things at once. It's typically seeing this otherworldly person on stage, and you can't believe that you're in the same room as this incredible person. And also at the same time thinking, oh, we're maybe not so different. We maybe have something in common. So that sense of difference and similarity at the same time, that to me is really the engine of popular music. And those two things we want from music, the idea that we want it to reflect us and we want it to be different from us. The idea that we want music to cross boundaries and represent freedom, but we also want it to give us a sense of community and give us a sense of intimacy. These things are in some ways incompatible, right? And the fact that we want incompatible things from music, that helps explain why music keeps evolving and keeps changing, and it also helps explain why we're always arguing over it, because it can never quite satisfy all those different, all those paradoxical things that we want it to do for us.
Well, and as you know, you're speaking to someone who spent his entire life in classical music, and indeed, it's not something at all covered in this book and not your aim. Maybe we can talk a little bit about how and why not and what kind of overlaps there are. But looking back on my early beginnings as a cellist, when I was 4 years old, picked up the instrument for the first time, I think there was nothing that could replicate the sound. It was the sound that I fell in love with, and many musicians say that they have the same experience. They hear the sound and they're off to the races.
Yes. And I started 1 year after you. I started playing violin when I was 5. I never quite mastered it, but I certainly, I put in a bunch of hours playing the violin and I liked it fine. And yes, there is that sound. But for me, and in this book, part of what I wanted to look at was the other thing, was the culture, was all the stuff that surrounds music. So I fell in love with punk rock when I was 14. And why? Well, it was maybe partly the sound, right? The sound of those electric guitars and someone screaming at you and the energy and the defiance. But it was also the culture. It was also the idea, as much as the music, it was the idea that you could enter this secret society, this society that defined itself in opposition to the so-called mainstream. And to me, that was seductive. Again, not so much of the sound, but because of the idea.
Now, what music do you think your father expected you to fall in love with instead of punk rock? What would the expectation have been?
Well, he loved classical music, and he also loved different kinds of African music, whether that is the more traditional griot music of the kora players that he grew up listening to, or the Afro-pop that was popular in the 60s and the 70s, so whether that's Youssou N'Dour or something else. I mean, he and obviously Paul Simon, Graceland was a popular album in my family. My mother is a linguist from South Africa, so she's probably one of the few American listeners who could understand all the lyrics on Graceland. So yes, maybe that was the expectation. And they were, I think, patient enough, maybe wise enough to kind of let me go and let me experiment. In other words, they didn't have to love Dead Kennedys the way I did, one of the punk bands I listened to. But I think maybe they realized like, oh, he's found something. He's found a tribe. He's found something to be really excited about. And the thing that really drew me to music and the thing that made me also want to write this book was the tribal nature of it. The idea that especially in the 90s, but even before and after that, you could walk into a high school and look at the way different students were dressed and figure out what music they listened to, maybe, right? And that you'd have the raver kids over here and the hip-hop fans over there and a bunch of punks in this place and maybe some people with cowboy hats over there who love country music. And so one of the things that popular music really does, that other forms of music maybe don't do the same way, that other art forms don't do in the same way, is that young people use that music to create their identity, to build their identity as a way of saying, this is the kind of person I am. Often that's a negative identity, right? Often that's, I'm not that kind of person. I'm this kind of person. Me and my friends are not like you and your friends. And I think that's a very adolescent impulse in a way, but it's also a very human impulse. Maybe that kind of divisiveness is a very American impulse. And I think that anyone who really loves popular music has felt that feeling of like, this is my stuff and I don't listen to that other stuff. And I think I wanted to make the argument that divisiveness, which we often talk about in a political context as a problem to solve, in the world of music and especially in the world of popular music, divisiveness can be extremely powerful. And divisiveness, that spirit of I'm not like you, is partly what creates this incredibly diverse and differentiated musical landscape that we have.
Not, because and, some and, people. And not just powerful, if I could just interject, not just powerful, but also useful in carving out a unique identity for different people and different groups.
Absolutely.
As you're saying, divisiveness, of course, it has a negative connotation because we hear it so much in a particular context, but it also forces people, in a sense, to raise the standard to which they artistically articulate their vision.
Yes, and it's something, you know, I sometimes say that this is a book about musical genres, right? And I list the seven that I'm, right? There's seven chapters about seven genres. It's rock and roll, R&B, country music, punk rock, hip hop, dance music, and pop music. And it's partly a defense of genres, but I sometimes say that genre in popular music is kind of just a slightly pretentious word for a community. And if you think about a genre as a community of musicians and listeners, then it's maybe a little bit easier to understand what the role that divisiveness plays. Because in order to have a community, you have to have some idea about who's in and who's out, right? A community relies upon a logic of inclusion and exclusion. And typically, genres do both. And often, the genres that claim to be the most inclusive, that claim to have the fewest rules, sometimes end up having the most rules, right? I grew up loving punk rock, and punk rock is a great example of a genre where they say, there's no rules, you can do whatever you want. But there is no genre that is more obsessed with the rules about who's in and who's out, and what are you supposed to do, and how are you supposed to make music, and who gets kicked out of the club than punk rock. And that's what gives it that sense of intimacy, which is, again, one of the things that we crave and one of the things that popular music can do really well is make you feel like you're part of a club, like you're part of a, you've entered a secret underground world. And, you know, at various times that can be enormously enriching, that can be stifling, that can be annoying, that can be exciting. And so, yeah, I wanted to kind of really explore that dynamic.
I'm curious how you went about setting out the organization of the book. Okay, seven chapters, seven. We'll use the word genre. People who listen to this podcast know I don't like the word genre much because particularly as a staunch advocate for the generalistic appeal, the mass appeal of classical music, I don't like the genre classical music because I think it sort of is a misnomer and it sort of turns people off in a way to begin with. But let's just leave that there. So seven genres here: rock, R&B, country, punk, hip-hop, dance, and pop. You're speaking to someone who probably knows less about these seven genres than anybody you've ever spoken to before.
You're right. You're my perfect audience then.
Exactly. So here we are, rolled up into 50 years, this extraordinarily diverse, vast, intricate, complicated mess, mush of great music. Organizationally, what did you do at the beginning? You're setting out to do it. I mean, you've spent a life in popular music writing about it. But here you're probably having to dive into things that maybe you weren't. I imagine not every genre in this book is your absolute personal favorite. So what did you do?
Well, I mean, obviously there is no getting away from personal taste, but that said, you know, I've been writing about music since the 90s. I certainly love things from all of these genres. These are all genres I listen to. But what I wanted to do was, I think a lot of people have a feeling that popular music got kind of weird, kind of fragmented, kind of obscure over the decades, right? Like that, you know, we kind of understand or we think we understand what happened with the Beatles, but that since then everything got a little bit confusing and that there's an awful lot of people that at this point are kind of like, you know, I don't actually know the difference between house and techno. I'm a little bit afraid to even ask what what that is. So what I wanted to do with this was I wanted to think about popular music, especially, although not exclusively, in America, and like when I say popular, I mean like what's on the pop charts, what's selling a lot of tickets in the arenas. And so I wanted to find these seven genres are, I think, seven broad tendencies that have been enormously influential in the story of what Americans listen to. And to do that, I had to set some limits, right? This is not a book about classical music. This is not a book about jazz. But I think all of these genres are in some sense mainstream. In other words, all of these are genres that were making big hits, that wanted to make big hits, that were thinking about pop charts. And I talk a lot about the Billboard charts in this book, partly because it's just a way of keeping score, right? Everyone's trying to get songs on the charts, and it's a way of really figuring out, like, well, what was on the radio in that week in 1978? And sometimes that's different from the stories that we've been told, right? Sometimes stuff that is super popular in one era kind of fades from history as we tell those stories. So I wanted to go back and look at what was happening contemporaneously as a way of figuring out how these things evolve. Now, some of these stories are bigger than others, right? The story of rock music, you know, it ranges from Paul Simon to death metal. I mean, this is a very broad genre. And in fact, one of the things that happens in rock music is because this is such a big and broad tendency, it fragments and you get subgenres and sub-subgenres, again, partly to create that sense of community. If you say like, oh, I'm like a rock fan, that's maybe a big and a vague term. It doesn't feel intimate. You know, if you say I'm a fan of classic death metal, well, then you have something in common with all the other people who like that thing. And so part of what I wanted to do, I've always written about music, or I've mainly written about music in general interest publications like the New York Times and the New Yorker. And part of what that means is knowing that someone who reads what I write isn't necessarily a fan of the thing that I'm writing about and might never listen to it. And so my job is not to convince you like, oh, you need to run out and buy a Cannibal Corpse album, right? My job is to just explain like, here's why people like that. Here's why it's exciting. Here's why it existed. Here's why it was different from what came before it. And I think that even someone who doesn't love any or many of these genres could hopefully enjoy just learning something about, like, here's why house and techno music emerged from the wreckage of disco. Or, you know, here's why everyone is still arguing over what it means to be a country singer. And so to me, those are fun stories that are as much stories about culture as they are stories about specific sounds.
Okay, let's just take a look at the basics for a moment. Rock music. It's the first one listed on the book, so it's the first one I'll just ask you about. When did rock music start, and what is rock music today versus when it started, and where did it start?
Well, so the roots of rock music, you know, go back earlier in the 20th century. Obviously, it's coming out of the blues, it's coming out of gospel, it's coming out of so-called rhythm and blues, and you get all this stuff sort of mixing up in the 40s and then in the 1950s. In order to have this rock and roll explosion in the 1960s. And one of the things that happens in the 1960s is people wonder if all these kinds of music are kind of going to just come together and everyone's going to be listening to similar stuff, right? People talk about youth culture. When people talk about the rock and roll revolution in the 1960s, they're talking about the Rolling Stones, but they're also talking about the Supremes, right? And so there is this idea that rock music is going to be integrated, that white kids and black kids are going to be listening to some of the same stuff. And in fact, there was a few years in the early 1960s where Billboard got rid of its R&B chart because all the songs on the R&B chart were becoming big pop hits, and they figured maybe this isn't even its own separate tradition anymore. Maybe rock and roll, pop music, R&B, maybe it's all getting mixed up into one thing. And so my book kind of picks up the story when that consensus is starting to unravel in the 1970s. One thing that happens by the early 1970s is this growing sense of rock and roll as white music. People knew that it had this black history, but the big performers were white. Some of the old instrumentation, you know, like saxophones, for instance, were starting to get downplayed. And the popular image of rock and roll in the 1970s is a white guy with an electric guitar. And part of what that means is that segregation, musical segregation, is reasserting itself. A lot of black musicians, sometimes even black musicians playing electric guitars, get considered R&B acts or soul acts. And so all of a sudden, it's the Rolling Stones are over here, and the Temptations are over there, and the idea, or Marvin Gaye, and the idea is they're making different music in different traditions. And so, you know, part of what happened with rock and roll music is that this rock star era, this idea that rock and roll is, you know, badly behaved white guys with electric guitars, that proved incredibly influential and incredibly long-lasting. One of the amazing things is that rock and roll becomes a very traditional genre. At the end of the 1970s, Rolling Stone publishes its guide to rock and roll, and they kind of insult Bruce Springsteen as saying, like, well, he's fine, but he's like a bit of a throwback, right? He emerges in the early 70s, but he's kind of this, has this old-fashioned idea of rock and roll. There's a wistfulness, there's a nostalgia in his music. But one of the things that Bruce Springsteen realized before a lot of his peers was that the future of rock and roll would belong precisely to the nostalgics, that rock and roll was growing increasingly self-conscious. You had a spate of songs in the 1970s about rock and roll, right? Meta rock and roll songs. It's only rock and roll, but I like it, right? So a self-consciousness about what this genre is, and a sense that there was some golden age in the past, and now the best we can do is to revive that. And that's kind of been the story of rock and roll ever since, a series of revivals and reappraisals, but always tinged with a certain amount of wistfulness, a certain amount of consciousness that we are living in the aftermath of this thing that happened in the 50s and 60s. And it's wild. If you talk to someone now in 2021, 2022, and they say that their favorite kind of music is rock and roll, they may well like many of the same bands that people were listening to 50 years ago. They may well love the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin. And so from one perspective, you could say that rock and roll kind of became stuck, but you could also just say that it became this very permanent feature on the American landscape of a very traditional music. Ironically, traditional even in comparison to something like country music. The sound of country music is always changing. What it means to be a country singer is always changing. We know what a rock and roll band looks like, right? We know it's a drummer, a bass guitarist, a guitarist or two, and then maybe a keyboard player and a singer, right? That's been set, that's been standard for years. Whereas in country music, it's a series of negotiations and revisions. Should we have drummers on the stage? Should we have a string section? Should we have a fiddle player? Are we allowed to use keyboards? Maybe now, in these days, you hear a lot of country music using electronic beats, right? Borrowing from hip-hop. So country music, the musical identity, keeps changing, and that makes it, in an odd way, more progressive than rock and roll, which has a more traditional musical identity. And it's often about going back and recovering some bygone energy of rock and roll past.
And indeed, with some of the great musicians we've had on here, whether it's Wynonna Judd or Petula Clark or Linda Ronstadt, who've joined me on this program, we talk about staying power. What do you think accounts for some of the staying power, the magnetism that is just as wildly popular today as it was 50 years ago for the Beatles, for example? We did a Beatles at the Symphony, you know, type of thing with the cover band, play all the songs and everything. I can't tell you how electrified and how passionate and teary-eyed the audience was. I could see the tears in the packed house, the emotions that the music evokes today. What is that about?
Well, it's both, right? It's both the right group, right? The brilliant musicians and the brilliant music they created, and the right moment. And sometimes those things meet, and so people not only love the music of the Beatles, they love the mythology and the story and what it represents. You see that with the new Peter Jackson documentary. But I think when you look at the history of music, it's sometimes hard to predict what it is that's going to have staying power, right? I remember when Britney Spears first emerges in the late 1990s, everyone assumes that, you know, she's some teeny bop star, she's going to be here today, gone tomorrow. But like that breakthrough Britney single, Hit Me Baby One More Time, basically never left the airwaves. It's almost as prominent now as it was 20 years ago. So the history of popular music is partly the history of groups like the Beatles that sort of enter the pantheon. but it's also the history of these, you know, seemingly silly songs that end up sticking around. If you go back to 1979, a group called the Sugar Hill Gang releases a record called Rapper's Delight. It's sort of a novelty song. It's the first, you know, one of the first rap records ever released. It sounds kind of silly to people. You know, the people in it aren't necessarily even like real rappers. But it becomes kind of a classic and one of the most influential records ever released because it marks the beginning of this hip-hop insurgency that hasn't stopped in over 40 years. So one of the fun things about music is, yes, there are these few figures like the Beatles who endure and who are never really replaced, right? There's never really a next Beatles. There's just the Beatles. But it's also the story of these things that are really hard to predict, and hard to predict what people will go back to, what people will reassess. And I also think one of the things that popular music does really well is it celebrates novelty. And I think to anyone who really loves popular music has some sympathy for the idea that there can be something really fun about a song, not a song that has stood the test of time, but a song that's really new, that sounds like now, right? The idea that you can listen to a song that sounds like 2021, there is something valuable about that too. I write in the book about maybe even rethinking this idea of standing the test of time. One way to think about that is that you have a lot of listeners spread out over the years, right? X number of people love this song now, X number of people love it in 30 years from now. And sometimes that's a cult act, right? Who has a slow but steady fan base that endures over the years. But sometimes in pop music, you get the opposite, right? You get a song that attracts a huge fan base in the moment, and then the fan base kind of dissipates. And I suggest in the book, I wonder whether it's possible to celebrate those kind of songs too. Is it possible to think about those songs where the fan base is kind of dying out and new people aren't interested in it? Is it possible to think about a song like that as the musical equivalent of a dying language? And there's something wistful about the idea that the last people who really understood this, who really enjoyed this, are gone. And there's not going to be any more people who understand why that resonated the way it did. And so the pleasure, one of the many pleasures that popular music affords sometimes, is the pleasure of transience.
We can't have this discussion without spending some time. Of course, we could spend time talking about every chapter in the book. But the singer-songwriter tradition in the United States, incredibly rich and incredibly diverse. And as you write in the early chapter in the book, I'm reading from your book here, every discussion of singer-songwriter music takes place in the shadow of Bob Dylan, who helped invent the form but kept reinventing himself, providing his fans so much delight and so much frustration that they sometimes found it hard to tell which was which. In 1970, in Rolling Stone, the critic Grail Marcus began his review of Dylan's latest self-portrait by asking, quote, "What is this shit?" Marcus emerged in the decades that followed as one of the most insightful scholars of Dylan, which is no small distinction. And his review was not a pan, or not merely a pan. It ran more than 7,000 words, a treatise on the general, if not invariable, greatness of Dylan and on the America that he loved to sing about. Self-portrait seemed designed to undermine the myth of Dylan as the ultimate singer-songwriter because it was a double album consisting mainly of cover versions. The title was paradoxical, and so was Marcus's argument, which was that by recording so many covers, Dylan seemed to, quote, turn inward, inviting listeners to wonder about his complicated personal motivations instead of helping them think about the wider world. As you say in parentheses, why on earth did he decide to interpret Blue Moon, one of the most familiar songs in the American songbook? Okay, what is the allure? What is the singular talent of Bob Dylan? You spend a lot of time writing about him, as you probably should and have to.
Yeah, I mean, Bob Dylan, he creates one of the really important archetypes, one of the important sets of expectations for what a musician should do, right? You know, coming the 60s, one of the things that happens in the 60s is this popularization of the idea that singers can and should write their own songs. And for Dylan, he kind of trains his audience to think of him, you know, almost like as a novelist, right? The musical version of an auteur. And the idea that every album is going to have new lyrics to obsess over, and it's going to it's going to complicate and add to the legacy of Bob Dylan. And wrestling with that legacy is one of the ways in which his music provides pleasure, right? That you can study it, you can read it in a way that is different from some other people. And so you get, you know, it's not just him, you get a cohort of these great singer-songwriters, right? I'd include Joni Mitchell, I would certainly include Paul Simon and many others. And that becomes a tradition, that becomes a way to do music. And that expectation gets applied to other people. I talk about how, you know, in the 1970s, Rod Stewart goes from being a sort of slightly Dylan-y rock and roll singer-songwriter to a guy who, you know, making disco records by the end of the 70s. And the idea is that you read in some of the reviews of the time is that when Stewart strays from that kind of Dylan-esque authenticity to make something that is, you know, quote-unquote just pop music, that he's lost something. And so in the decades since then, even musicians who sound nothing like Bob Dylan, I'm thinking of the brilliant singer-songwriter and harp player Joanna Newsom, who's, you know, about as much a composer as she is a singer-songwriter, you get people who find new ways to engage with that tradition of I'm going to write and perform my own music, and it's going to reward close study. It's not necessarily going to be something you can sing along with on the radio. Dylan certainly has his share of sing-alongs, but part of the reason that people love his catalog is the idea that you can sit down and really lose yourself in them. There's also this idea of solitariness, right? Part of what he popularized was the idea of the singer-songwriter as a solitary figure. In fact, that's kind of what singer-songwriter means. A singer-songwriter is just a term that we have for a pop musician who doesn't collaborate that much, right? The expectation with a singer-songwriter is that you write your own songs by yourself and then you sing them. And that's a tradition that fits some artists really well. It fits some other artists less well. I think a lot of times in black musical traditions, there is a premium placed on collaboration, right? When you think about, for example, how in hip hop, rappers and producers tend to collaborate with producers creating the music, building the track, and then rappers adding the lyrics. There's a kind of a division of labor, so you wouldn't consider a rapper a singer-songwriter, right? Because they collaborate too much. And so that mode of solitary production is something that is enormously seductive. It's considered very prestigious, right? You see pop stars like Taylor Swift, you know, kind of insisting on themselves as singers and songwriters, even when, you know, in the case of Taylor Swift, you have someone who actually does collaborate a lot with her songwriting. But there is something prestigious about this idea of being a singer-songwriter. And a lot of that traces back to the legacy of Bob Dylan, and that became an example that a lot of other singers and musicians aspire to.
And there's certainly some allure there, even to someone who has no connection to it. For example, when I was in elementary school, I went once a week for pottery lessons after school, and the pottery teacher always put on Bob Dylan. She was a woman from that generation, and you know, what is a fourth grader in New Hampshire know particularly about that? Nothing, but I absolutely loved it. I was totally taken by it, and when I wasn't listening to La Boheme or Don Giovanni, I wanted to hear Bob Dylan. And and actually in an odd sense, I also liked Bob Marley a lot in those years, and I had no connection to that either whatsoever, even less than Bob Dylan probably. But who knows? I think when you're a kid, there's something wonderful about I go back to the sound thing, because I think it was just something about the sound of both those guys that I really liked. And if you start thinking about it and asking why, sometimes that can ruin it.
I hope not. It hasn't ruined it for me, and I've been thinking about and asking those kind of questions ever since I was a teenager. You know, but for me, it's also those extra musical things, right? And that's the place where, you know, I think that that's the thing that popular music is so good at, right? Is that, like, if you like this thing, you can, if you like this song, if you like this sound, you can enter into that world if you want to, right? You can dress the part. You can go to those parties. You can meet those people. And even if you don't, you can imagine yourself into that world, right? You can put on a hip-hop album and imagine being part of that world that that album comes from. You can imagine living the life and feeling some of the things that the rapper is telling you about in the lyrics. And that is, I think that's part of the reason why popular music has had this extraordinary power. And that has often, you know, been some of the focus for popular musicians. You know, compared to classical music, often the melodic structures will be fairly simple, sometimes intentionally rudimentary. And the thing and the complexity in popular music often lies a little bit less in like the chord progression and more in the way in which the performer is manipulating that sense of cultural reality, the way the performer is telling you what kind of person they are and giving you a way to sort of think about the world. I think that's part of the reason why some of these discussions about popular music tend so often to be about other people, right? Because it's social. It's something we listen to in the background often. It's something we listen to with other people. And so often we end up thinking about other people as we listen to it, whether that's you thinking about your pottery class when you hear Bob Dylan, or whether that's someone who puts on a country record now and is thinking about like the people who love country audience and the world of country fans. And it's a slightly different world. And for me, when I was a pop music critic at the New York Times in the 2000s, and for me during those years, part of the fun of going to these shows was that it really did feel like entering different worlds, right? Now I'm at an indie rock concert in Brooklyn. Now I'm driving out to Jersey to see a country show. Now I'm in some club listening to techno, and it really was like going from one world to another. The people had something in common. It was generally people who loved music. But beyond that, it was very different crowds, very different expectations, and very different things they wanted from music. And to me, part of the fun of thinking about music, and luckily for me, this has not spoiled any of the pleasure. Quite the opposite, it's enlarged the pleasure that I get from it, is thinking about what people really want from it and why.
A part of the book that you just sort of alluded to, the different crowds wanting different things. Different crowds go to a country music concert than might go to an indie rock concert, then might go to an R&B show at an arena or something like that. So what are the different crowds? It's inevitable that the discussion of race would come up in this book. Obviously, music and the past 50 years in America, they're intertwined. The frustrations, the passions, the divisions, the hopes and dreams. There's no better place to articulate all of that than music.
Yes, and it's the question in particular, you know, often it starts with the question of black music. What is black music? How do we feel about the fact that something called black music exists? You know, Marvin Gaye in his biography talked about, you know, the great soul singer Marvin Gaye talked about how what he really wanted deep down was to be like a supper club act, right? Because that was the ultimate prestigious position to have, was to be Frank Sinatra and to be able to sit down on a stool and perform. I think he said something like for an audience of like rich white Republicans, like that was in some ways, that was the goal. And he talked about the fact that he never achieved that and that he remained an R&B singer. And he said kind of in a sort of self-pitying way, here I am after all these years, still out here on the R&B circuit, basically like shaking my backside to the fans, right? And the idea was that this was a harder and maybe less prestigious way to earn a living. And, you know, you often hear that when you hear black musicians talking about their mixed feelings about being categorized as black musicians. One of the things that means is that maybe the audience is going to be predominantly or disproportionately black, which can be nice in a sense, right? There's a sense if you're a black musician, maybe of like, I'm performing for my people, right? If you were performing for an audience that perfectly reflected the demographics of America, that audience would be only 12% black, and black listeners would be a small minority in your audience, and that might not feel great either. On the flip side, it's often felt like segregation, like a barrier to black musicians to say, wait a second, I want to reach everyone. I don't want to just be limited to this group. And so that back and forth is something that's really shaped the modern history of black music. You see that there's an extraordinary moment in, I think it's 1982, where Billboard has been publishing this chart of R&B music, top R&B songs. The name gets changed in the late 60s to top soul music songs, because soul music is then the popular term. And in the early 1980s, soul music as a term starts to seem a little bit old-fashioned, a little too 70s, and so they rename it their Black Music Chart. And it's an extraordinary moment because some musicians say, like, this is great. We're going to acknowledge the Black history of this music. We're going to have a term that's inclusive musically, because Black music as a term could include not just R&B, but jazz. It could include blues. It could include gospel. What a great term to recognize this. And you have other musicians who say, wait a second, this feels a little bit like segregation. This feels a little bit like you're confining us over here, and anyone who's Black and making music is going to be over here making so-called Black music.
Well, what's your opinion, Khalifa?
I think the drive toward integration and the drive towards segregation, I think those are both really understandable urges. I think that there's reason. In the late 1980s, Nelson George publishes this great book called The Death of Rhythm and Blues. And his argument is that in the era of Prince and Michael Jackson and all these R&B singers having pop success, R&B as a genre is losing its identity, and that's maybe a bad thing. And so, you know, that's an argument for the downsides of crossover. And I do think that there is something valuable to having music that reflects the way people live in America. And that's one of the most popular and one of the most important things that popular music can do. So my position is that as long as Americans are living lives that are to some extent segregated, as long as our social divisions are partly racial divisions, I want to hear that reflected in music, because I want to hear music that reflects the lives that we live.
But do you want to see that in the audiences as well, or do you not have a preference?
I think those things go together. I think certainly it's important to make sure, you know, I certainly like the idea of people being accepted, right? So it's not so in different places, and I think you will naturally see, you know, some mixing and matching the same way you do in our neighborhoods. But I think to the extent, I'd like to see all the different communities that we have reflected in music. And if there are places, and if it is still the fact that there are places in America where white people hang out and that are disproportionately white, just as there are places that are disproportionately Black, I'm curious to hear the music of all those different places. And I think that that's one of the great services that music can do, is it can help you inhabit different worlds.
There's something to what you're saying that it goes back to what we were talking about at the very beginning, the divisions, the divisiveness. It makes for a much more interesting cultural scene. Of course, we all can and should work to make social progress in our country day by day. And we all, I think... the great vast majority of American citizens, contrary to what you might hear on social media or see reported, I think most people really do want to just make progress together bit by bit. But at the same time, we can certainly be grateful for the great identity of the different musics that this country has produced.
Absolutely. And I think you see that in country music, right? You see that in country music that often, again, because
what is
we
country
love
music? Just give a little background on country music for those who might not know, because I don't know a lot about it. What is country music? And then tell us that, use that as the example that you were alluding to, if you would.
Well, country music emerges as a fusion of a bunch of different American roots musics, right? And some of it is Appalachian string music. Later, you get added to that Western swing, which is a kind of a jazz-influenced music. When Billboard starts publishing its chart, it's a country and Western chart to suggest that those are two similar but maybe separate traditions. And then, you know, certainly by the 1960s, you've gotten those things fused into what we call country music, which still has this kind of cowboy imagery from the West, and it still has a little bit of this hillbilly reputation, which is a little more Eastern. And it also has this cultural identity. It's a cultural identity of being white music, even though, of course, it has Black musical roots, but it reflects the ongoing segregation of American life. And at various times, it's meant different things. I think ever since the emergence of rock and roll, country music has had to contend with the fact that it's not rock and roll. In other words, rock and roll emerges as like this music for young people. And ever since then, part of the identity of country music has been like, well, I guess we're music for like slightly older people. And does that mean, and so you get that in the 1960s and 70s, you get a, you know, what they call the Nashville sound, and this tradition of, you know, singers in ball gowns accompanied by, you know, orchestras, and the idea of like, this is maybe more grown up music. In the 1970s, you get the outlaw country music, right? Which is a move back toward authenticity. And the idea of like, this is not going to be mainstream music anymore. This is going to be, you know, Waylon Jennings and Willie Nelson. And this is going to be music that is countercultural in some sense. And the question of how countercultural country music really wants to be is a complicated question. By the 1990s, it has a more suburban identity, right? It's Garth Brooks. It's Shania Twain. It's the music of normal America. Maybe I should say North America. Shania Twain, obviously Canadian. And so that keeps changing. And again, the question of how inclusive country music should be is a complicated one. There have, of course, been black country stars, although not that many. It's kept its reputation as being music for white people. Some people have tried to complicate that in interesting ways. Tim McGraw, a country star from the last couple decades, has a great song called Southern Voice, where he talks about, like, no, this is the music of Hank Williams and Hank Aaron, right? And and so he tries to, he's claiming a broader Southern tradition. But even that is, in a sense, divisive, right? Because that's a racially inclusive, but it's not geographically inclusive, right? This is music for all kinds of people as long as they're from the South. And I think that gets to this issue of, if country music is going to have an identity, the identity can't be, oh, it's just everyone in America, right? That doesn't work. That doesn't create that sense of cultural identity. So what is it that makes you a country? Is it, it's not strictly rural. It's not strictly Southern. It's not even necessarily strictly white, but there is an identity that people can somehow realize and relate to. One of the stories I tell in my book is Morgan Wallen, who's one of the most popular country music singers of the moment. He comes from a small town in Tennessee called Sneedville, and he grew up listening to rock music. He grew up listening to, like, Nickelback, bands like that. And I asked him, like, oh, well, when did you get obsessed with country music? And he kind of paused and he said, well, I was never really that obsessed with country music. I just, like, started singing songs, and they just kind of came out country, right? The idea is, like, that identity that he had a cultural identity that pre-existed his musical identity as a country star. And because of that cultural identity, because of his life in this small town in Tennessee, his references and something about his accent and something about him ended up coming out country, even though that wasn't his intention. And so one of the definitions of country music is that it is a culture, right? It's something you're born into. It's a way of life. That's the, I sometimes think of it as the Dolly Parton definition, where Dolly Parton is so country to her core that even when she's singing 9 to 5, which is basically a disco song, it still feels country because it's coming from Dolly Parton. And that definition of country, it allows, on the one hand, an enormous amount of musical freedom, right? It means that you're free to go explore disco music. You're free to use hip-hop beats, as Morgan Wallen does on his record. But it also means that there is this other way of thinking about insiders and outsiders. And then if you're not born into this world, if you're not really part of this culture, maybe you can never really join.
And at the same time, it's always funny to see who likes what. As you know, we always talk music with people on this program, no matter who you are. So when Ambassador Dennis Ross was on, who is the Middle East peace envoy for 4 presidents to Israel, he confessed that his great love is driving around D.C. after a big negotiation, singing along to country music. And he said he had never told anybody that before, and he was a little embarrassed.
Nothing embarrassing about driving around singing to country music. I've done more than my fair share of that.
I told him this is a safe space and to continue confessing his embarrassing musical situations, and he would not be judged. And I'm glad you confirmed that. So right now, 2021 going into 2022, Caleb Hassana, how is the American popular music scene? Do these 7 genres still have the distinctiveness that they did 30, 40 years ago? Are they all thriving? What genre is doing the best right now in terms of creativity?
Well, you know, I think there are genres. I think most of these genres do still exist in a meaningful way, but certainly that meaning is changing, right? There are still certainly people waving the flag for hip-hop, although what that means is slowly changing, right? You're seeing people, Drake helped change this, the idea that you could be a rapper and also a singer and still be hip-hop, right? So that the genre of hip-hop is maybe no longer so closely tied to the practice of rapping. Similarly, in country music, you still have these big arguments about what is or what isn't country music. Is Lil Nas X on the country chart? Should Kacey Musgraves be nominated for a Grammy in the country category? Or is she more pop? Or is she more Americana? So these things are still considered worth fighting over. That said, we're living a lot of the institutions that helped strengthen this sense of genre now seem a little bit old-fashioned, right? Radio stations helped reinforce this idea of genre, right? Because they used that as a rallying cry for their listeners, right? They could tell their listeners, this is your home for rock and roll. This is, you know, this is the cat, your country station. And so as a lot of music listening moves online, there is a question of, like, does genre even still matter the way it used to? I mentioned Lil Nas X. He's a good example of someone who draws from a bunch of different genres, and people sometimes talk about Spotify pop, named after the streaming service Spotify, and the idea that, like, oh, all these things kind of mix and blend together on a service like Spotify, and maybe you don't have to pick and choose your genre. The thing that I learned more than anything, writing this book, going back and reading, rereading, you know, the coverage of music over the last 50 years, is that this moment is not as unprecedented as we might think. You think about the late 70s and the height of the disco revolution, where it felt similarly like everything was coming together. Right, you could be the Rolling Stones, you could be Diana Ross, you could be Star Wars, the Bee Gees. Everyone is making disco hits, and that was something really utopian about that, right? The idea that we're all going to come together on the dance floor, black, white, Hispanic, gay, straight, it's going to be Europeans, Americans, it's going to be drawing from funk and R&B, and there's going to be electronic music, and rock bands are going to be using the disco beat, and we're all going to be there losing ourselves in communal ecstasy on the dance floor, right? A really uplifting story. Of course, we know now that one of the things that happens with the disco era is you get an enormous backlash. You get a moment in Chicago where they organize an event where people can bring disco records and get reduced admission, and they're going to burn these disco records in a pyre in the middle of the outfield as a way of saying goodbye to the disco era. And this burning of disco records, you know, turns into a riot. They actually have to cancel the second game of the doubleheader, and the disco riot comes to symbolize this backlash, in some cases a very ugly backlash, against the disco moment. And I think that that's instructive. I think out of that backlash comes a renewed excitement about rock and roll. Out of that backlash comes R&B embracing newer rhythmic patterns as a way to separate themselves from disco. To get musical for a second, the disco beat is more of a what they call a four on the floor beat, and R&B in the wake of the disco collapse goes more towards a harder backbeat rhythmic pattern as a way of saying we've moved on, we understand it's the 80s, it's not the 70s anymore. You get new forms of dance music that emerge as producers try to distance themselves from disco. So one theory about what's happening now is that we're living through the modern equivalent of a disco moment, when all sorts of genres are coming together and mingling on Spotify, and it sometimes feels as if everyone's listening to the same thing, as if, like, there's a few songs that everyone seems to know, and these distinctions are fading a little bit. And if history is any guide, those moments where it feels like everyone is listening to the same kind of songs in the world of popular music are followed by moments of backlash, moments of segregation, moments of division, moments of musicians and listeners finding ways to say, no, I don't want to be part of this thing that quote-unquote everyone is doing. I want to be doing something different. Me and my friends are not like you and your friends. So one way of thinking about the current moment is to imagine that this time of everyone coming together is just setting the stage for the next backlash, the next genre moment, the next moment when we once again break into tribes and things get all fragmented all over again.
And meanwhile, on the side or on the periphery or lingering somewhere through the centuries, it's classical music, which, contrary to predictions by I hate to say it, music writers over the years or other mm-hmm. cultural commentators, is still here. And I would say in many ways thriving. Packed houses, when I play chamber music all over the world, when I play symphonies, packed houses for now. Let's see, maybe things will change with a new variant or something. But I think the passions for Beethoven, Brahms, the passions for even sometimes some new music mixed in. I'm a cyclist. I was riding a century 100 miles on a couple days ago. I was with someone and he said, well, we used to go to the symphony, but they started playing too much 20th century music, so we canceled our subscription. I said, you know, you could always just come for the second half because that's when we usually do the Beethoven.
Well, yeah, and you see that model of music that's nurtured in conservatories, music that exists in the world more of like nonprofit institutions, you see other genres being welcomed into that, right? You've seen that happen with jazz to a certain extent. You maybe seen that happen to an extent with the Great American Songbook.
Is that the right thing? Is that the right thing, though, to welcome them in? Or should people to welcome them in? Or should people, meaning institutions, cultural institutions like a symphony be providing more of what the sort of backbone of the symphonic repertoire is? There's some people who believe that that maybe, you know, leave the Beatles cover show or the whatever else, you know, New Orleans brass band collaborations, maybe leave that to the experts, leave that to the people who really know how to do it and play more Beethoven.
Yeah, I'm certainly not suggesting that they would need to be welcomed into the same institutions, right? Certainly in New York here, we have jazz at Lincoln Center kind of in parallel to Lincoln Center. And I'm not suggesting that jazz doesn't deserve its own institutions, which you see being built now. I'm just talking about that model of transmission, right? I think oddly, there's things that other genres, other kinds of music could learn from classical music, right? The way that classical music is sustained, the business model. And so what I'm curious about is the extent to which you're, like I said, you're already seeing that for jazz. You're seeing that to an extent to Great American Songbook. Is there going to be a time when people can go to college and do graduate work in learning how to play guitar, where the great rock guitarists are coming out of these programs as opposed to just, you know, learning it on their own? That's something, that institutionalization process, again, not necessarily joining the same institutions, but that institutionalization process is something that is happening. In some ways, I'm surprised that some of these newer popular genres have resisted that as long as they have, right? I'm surprised that that hip hop, for example, which has been going since the mid-1970s, isn't more respectable than it is, that hip hop still is considered and still functions as a very kind of grassroots, streets-driven phenomenon. And so one of the questions I'm interested in is how long that can continue. And it's possible, right? It's possible that music, popular music, gets displaced, right? It's possible that future generations are more interested in defining themselves through politics, through video games, through something else, and through fashion, through something else entirely. Music doesn't always have to play that role, right? Music doesn't always have to be the thing that determines what kind of a young person you are. You look at something like theater. You can't really go to a high school and look at how people are dressed and guess who their favorite playwright is. But you can still do that to an extent with popular music. And so the interesting question is how long popular music maintains that power that it's had to define identity. And one of the things I wanted to do is, you mentioned golden age at the beginning and the question of whether we're living in a golden age. I think almost by definition, one of the things that characterizes a golden age is that often people don't seem to realize it's happening until it's over. And so one of the things I wanted to do was celebrate at least the last 50 years as a golden age of self-definition through music. That this is maybe will turn out to be the high watermark of people saying, pointing to a record, pointing to an artist and saying, I'm that kind of person. You know, I'm a punk. I'm a country listener. I'm an R&B person. I'm a raver. And you know, maybe in retrospect, that's kind of a strange thing that people decided to do at the end of the 20th century. But I like the idea of celebrating.
I love the idea of celebrating it. Give us something to celebrate. Some recommendations to celebrate this next period. It's going to be winter. It's going to be cold. People are going to be inside more, looking for things to listen to. Give us some names. What's really good right now, or a really good 50-year-old song that you think just needs to be listened to more?
I love, you know, there's a band called Big Thief that I think is making really great records right now. There's a lot of great music coming out of Puerto Rico in what they call Latin trap or reggaeton. There's an artist called Bad Bunny who I think might be one of those artists that 10, 20, 30 years from now, people look back and see the kinds of records that he was making as the sort of maybe the spark of the next big important music. I think the story of American music in the next 10, 20, 30 years will largely be the story of Latin music. And finally, there's a British producer who calls himself Fred Again, who kind of makes dance music, but who has made a couple now of albums during the pandemic that sort of try to tackle this question of what does it mean to make dance music at a time when so many people are stuck inside? And so this is this slightly paradoxical category of dance records for people who are stuck in their own homes. Fred Again is his name, and I think those are really interesting records that reflect something of the current moment.
We will go listen. We'll go to Spotify or wherever we find our music. We'll go to your recommendations. We'll report back. We'll share with our friends. And hopefully we'll get in some time, maybe for a Schubert piano sonata in between explorations. Calavasana, I indeed thank you very much. Wish we could talk for more, but hope there will be another time. Thank you.
You've been listening to Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk. The original theme music is by Ronald Barkham. The content coordinator is Nathaniel Mosse, and Doug Christian is executive producer. We invite you to subscribe and leave a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. You can support us at patreon.com/talkingbeats. That's patreon.com/talkingbeats. And be sure to check us out on social media. We'll see you next time on Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk.